This is talking with Mukul Kundu at Maryland on 18th December, 73. So you began in France, actually. About when did you say?
1954.
And where was this in France?
At that time, the French group was not at Maison Observatory. It was École Normale Supérieure.
Right.
And it was a very small group, really, and that's because that's how it started.
Who was in the group? Can you just name the
yes,
people?
Yes, I can name Bloom. I must say first, Denise, Steinberg, Bloom, Boisho, Cazes. There was a young fellow, Alan, who eventually left the group because he wanted, he was more interested in electronics. Arsak, Simone. I don't know if you have heard of this gentleman's name, Gina.
How do you spell that?
G-I-N-A-T. He was involved with building this large telescope at NASA.
I see.
But he was a mountaineer, so he died in one of those...
In the war?
One of those mountaineering expeditions, David.
Oh, I'm sorry, you said mountaineer.
Right. I joined only in the later, in September, I think. September of 54.
But now, did you go there as a graduate student, or as a...
Yes, that's the way it was. But it's not exactly the American system anyway. I got a French government scholarship, so I went there with the purpose of doing my PhD there. That's how I joined this group.
And did you go there specifically to do radio astronomy, or
specifically
how had you gotten interested in that?
I did my bachelor's degree in physics. But then I did my master's degree in radio physics, really. So, and I was doing for a while in India ionospheric research, which I discovered after a couple of years that I didn't like it at all. So I applied for some government, French government scholarship, and I also had applied for a German government scholarship. And I got both. If I did go to Germany at that time, I would have done theoretical work with Schlüter. If I went to France, I thought the best thing for me to do would be radio astronomy, because this was in 1954. That was, I think, a good time to start radio astronomy, no matter where you start.
This was the same Schlüter that did do some radio astronomy theory.
No, this is a theoretical plasma phase theory. That's right.
He did do some stuff on the sun, didn't he?
Yeah.
Inspired by the radio.
Right. So I thought I just chose France. That's because I had the radio background, at least. At that time, radio astronomy was done by radio engineers.
Right.
So I had to build my equipment. I thought I'd just try that. When I decided to radio astronomy, I had no clear idea of astronomy, I must admit. Because I had not studied any astronomy at all, just a little bit, but not much.
So that's how I ended up. What did you do when you got there, then?
Well, I joined a group. With Steinberg to do this, at that time it can be considered the high resolution interferometry, but of the sun. It was a two element interferometer. It was supposed to be, which I had to build actually, sometimes with the help of Steinberg. And this guy helped me also a lot, Alan, who left because he was an electronics engineer. So I started learning how to build amplifiers and so on, and then how to put the waveguides together, and how to build the antennas, or rather the antennas are built, how to put them together.
And what frequency was
this? This was at 3 centimeter, and the separation was 2000 wavelengths. And I think that was the first time the concept of a tracking interferometer was used. So it was a novel instrument. And actually, I think in all fairness, it can be said probably that is the first one which was constructed, which used to a limited extent the aperture synthesis concept. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it also, it was, I suppose, the highest frequency interferometer.
Right, at that time it was the highest one. 3 centimeter, 2000 wavelengths, 1.5 meter wide. what we actually wanted to do, since the sun was sort of a symmetrical object anyway, and we've got sources for all practical purposes. You can consider that these sources within the sun, which are associated with hot spots, flowers, and so on. They are, you have to make this assumption. They are circularly symmetric. So by using this,
you don't have to have phases. You
right. Know. We didn't have the phase at that time. But using this baseline, you can pick up the various Fourier components in the spectrum, and you plotted the brightness distribution from them.
Right.
And that was an achievement at that time, you see. But you couldn't make the complete map following right. this because you didn't have the phase information.
And now this was, what time did this work actually get done then? In 56,
beginning of 56 it started working. It took 2 years to put together everything. And I think in middle of 56, I mean, we had fringes from sources of the order of 1 minute of arc on the sun, actually, which was great at that time because we didn't have 56. That was almost 20 years ago.
Right. Now, this was using the two Wurzburg dishes, is that correct?
No.
No?
No. That was used, that was not quite put together at that time. This was, I don't know, have you visited NASA?
No, I never got there.
There were two 7-foot dishes, really. Maybe 10-foot, something of that yeah. order, anyway. Something like 10-foot dishes. That was good enough for the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, that's it. That was the work involved. So as a byproduct, we got a lot of interesting stuff which nobody else got. For example, when you track the sun, and this was not a multiplying, not a phase-switched interferometer. It was an adding interferometer. So what you get, first of all, you get the fringes from sources which are less than about 1 minute of arc. And in addition, if there is a flare, you see the fringes, just like the kind of records these people are getting now at NRAO. You see, mm-hmm. you've got a flare star,
yeah.
you get the fringe amplitude. But I think this adding interferometer is, if the source is not a point source, is more powerful because you've got the total intensity at the same time.
That's right.
You see?
Yes.
So you get the fringe visibility as a function of time. So you get the evolution of the burst size as a function of time. That means you get getting the brightness temperatures at different times of the flare, you see. So that was a right. very important thing which came out as yeah. a result of these observations.
A basic assumption of the phase switching interferometer is that it's not variable with time. And
right.
And that it's
also, it is
also
very difficult.
Yeah.
Right. You cannot get the total intensity easily, you see, unless it is a point source.
Right. But it's easier for positions. So.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Position, of course, you can do, even with the adding interferometer, you can do quite well if you had another interferometer to resolve the ambiguity. Another antenna, that's what you need.
But then again, you weren't working with the problem of a very weak signal on top of a strong background,
no,
either.
No. Right. Right.
Yeah. When you're looking at these mm-hmm. flares.
Right.
Now, was this stuff published in Annales d'Astrophysique?
Right, that's the one. It's still as a supplement. That's, I think, leaving aside some unnecessary details, that was my thesis, really,
mm-hmm.
in volume 22. It's funny enough, it is still, even after almost 20 years actually, it is still being referred to. Yes. Because not many people have got, even now, that kind of resolution, especially the people who deal with the sun, they don't have access to telescopes like the Westerbork or NRAO
mm-hmm.
right. and so on. So, 1 or 1.5 meters.
That's true.
Still,
at the lower frequencies, of
right.
course, you have Kogura, but
right.
at the high frequencies.
Right.
So what was next? Next stage after that?
Well, that was, because I got my degree in 57, end of 57, actually I sort of cheated in a way. The 19th of December, I wanted to do it. If I didn't do it at the time, it would have been 1958, you see.
yeah.
So I persuaded the members of the committee to get together just before Christmas, but anyway, it was done. After that, I stayed on for another 8 months or so until the Paris Symposium on radio astronomy. I thought it would be very useful
right.
to me. So, after that, I went to India.
What about that meeting? You say you found it useful?
Yeah.
In what way?
Well, that was the first time I would have attended an international conference, so it was worthwhile
yeah.
for me. And well, presented. Two papers out of my thesis anyway, which were completely new at that time. Nobody had that kind of measurements before. And well, I got to know what is radio astronomy about, really. That's sad.
Yeah. It's often said that that's sort of the last time that all the radio astronomers in the world could get together in one place at mm-hmm. one time. But for right. you, it was the first.
For me, it was the first time I had ever attended.
Yeah.
A radio astronomical conference. Yeah.
So you went back to India, and did you continue with the radio astronomy there?
Yes, I'm 58. I was there for 1 year at Delhi, which is the National Physical Laboratory. And there was nothing there, but I was supposed to build something. I tried to build again the same sort of thing, since at a different frequency. Tried to build some amplifiers and so on. But after about a year, or rather after 6 to 8 months, something like that, and I sort of fed up really, because I didn't have a good job. I had a fellowship which was at the time was well, very poorly paid. I couldn't just maintain even on Indian standards. Mm-hmm. So then I at the Paris Symposium, somebody Leo Goldberg had asked me that if I ever wanted to come to the United States to write him, let him know. So I wrote my letter, and within 1 week I got an offer of a job. So I came to Michigan. At the time Goldberg was in Michigan.
Oh, he was in Michigan, I see.
He was in Michigan.
Yeah. But before we get back to the States, can I just ask you, when was the earliest radio astronomy in India of any kind?
Of any kind is, I don't know whether you should include that. Maybe around that time, I think various other people, what all they were doing, 58 or 59, just build a radio meter and connect it to an antenna and record the sun, the solar flux.
Right.
That's it.
Just monitoring
the sun. If you consider that as radio astronomy, that's probably the time it started.
But nothing before the late 50s?
Nothing. I don't believe so. It might have started, I'm not aware of.
Who was the person to that could really answer that question?
I think this is probably at Kodai Canal. I think I know that some activity was going on to record the solar flux at that time. And. Right now, I think the director of Kodai Canal Observatory should be able to answer who. But I think around that time, somebody was monitoring the sun. I'm not quite sure, but anyway, efforts were going on at that time to do something about it.
There was nothing other than that?
Nothing other than that, not to my knowledge.
Okay, so you went back to Michigan in 59, or you went to
59,
Michigan?
That's right. 59. Exactly. I was in India exactly 1 year. So.
And what was going on up there at that time?
At that time, Michigan, they had this 28-foot telescope, like Alan Maxwell had, with a number of dynamic spectrum analyzers.
First one he had at Fort Davis.
Right. Yeah. I think Fred Haddock had a very similar system there, and. So they had a lot of data there. So I was my job was to analyze those solar records, really. And that's how it started.
And what came out of that? And
I don't know. Just quite a few papers out of that kind of solar analysis. It's mainly the dynamic spectrum analyzer records, and which consist of various kinds of bursts. That's what you can do actually with that kind of instrument. And these are only the frequency, time, and intensity profiles. So we have got type 4 and type 2 and type 3 bursts. Mm-hmm. I was interested in type 4 because I had already started. Even with that interferometer which I had built in France, doing some type 4 work, so I was interested. And specifically, I think some important results which came out was solar cosmic rays. Until then, for example, people believed solar cosmic rays were more closely related with meter wave type 4, you see. And what I did actually, in fact, within a month or so after I came here, showed that actually it is not so. It's the centimeter wave, intense centimeter wave bursts, which are about a very broad spectrum, were much more closely associated with cosmic rays. In fact, you could almost predict you will get solar cosmic ray events, I mean, the proton events from centimeter wave data, I think. Something like 85 to 90% probability, and it is still it's still true.
And when was this established?
This was I think this was presented. I think I presented a paper in 59 December or so, something like that.
In 59?
Yeah.
Oh, I see. So I came very soon after you got to Michigan.
Michigan. Yeah, sure. And until then, I'm not sure. It either 59, end of 59 or beginning of 60. It must be 59 because I wrote a paper actually, in, which was published in 1960, I think.
But was this based on the Michigan data?
Well, Michigan data plus data collected all over the world.
Because oh, I
Michigan,
see. So you just took all
right,
available
right,
data.
Right. It's a complete analysis, really. Because Michigan had no centimeter data.
That's what I was
time.
Wondering, yeah.
Right. So, but that's how I started. But when you start with one thing, you have to take into account in solar work, particularly you take into account the data from other places.
Yeah.
Well, that's one thing to mention, what file. And the other thing is X-ray, solar X-ray bursts, where again it is not based on the Michigan data, but being in Michigan and having to deal with the data, you have to look into other kinds of data. Again, it was discovered that all these balloon X-ray events, hard, hard X-rays, or even sometimes even soft X-rays, were again 100% correlated with impulsive centimeter wave bursts. Again, that was the first time, because until then, I think it was believed that the type 3s which produce these X-ray bursts. You see, I think that was again one important. Important is that because this is still the model used at the time. That was, I think, in 1961 actually. I presented a paper at the IUU Berkeley meeting. And that model is still true. I think there are some minor deviations here and there, but I think basically the concept of Bremsstrahlung producing the microwave bursts and the X-ray bursts is still is still true. And type 3, if they are produced, type 3 electrons. Type 3 bursts, if they are produced, is incidental. It's not the same electrons which produce this burst. It's other electrons which go upward, rather than the electrons which are contained at the lower levels.
Right.
So I think that was to mention among other things the two important things. Plus there's another paper which I produced is on type 4, the evolution of type 4, which means really the dissecting the type 4 into various stages and the various properties, and that has got some bearing on the generating mechanisms of the various phases of type 4, really, how the electrons are produced, accelerated, and so on, starting with the centimeter wave burst and goes up to meter.
By phases, you mean that during the development of the
right.
Of the burst,
yeah. Well, so that's, and then I started writing this book actually on solar radiostronomy.
Yeah, that was much earlier than it was finally published, or you
right.
started, wasn't it?
Right. It was, I started really end of 69, and it was carried...
End of 59?
No, 61 I meant.
Oh,
61.
End
of 61. And then it was carried through the middle of 62, and then I went to Cornell, so I had a job there. I got a faculty job, associate professor in Cornell, so I thought it was a better job for me, so I went there. I really couldn't finish this. It started as a report, a Michigan report, but it took me another 2 years, really, to finish it. But that was a hard job, because probably the same kind of job you are doing now. You are collecting, there was nothing available in the form of a book or a review, nothing at all. And the solar stuff, being messy as it is, it's a hard job, really. So.
But you weren't intending for a book originally, just only for a extensive report?
It's not quite true, but I had, although I didn't mention it, I had it in the back of my mind. I was always very modest. I had it in the back of my mind, it must come out as a book after having spent so much time and energy. But it came as a report to Michigan because that was the contract I had actually. So it was published as a report in the middle of 64, really.
Right, and when you started, the only books on radio astronomy, besides the popular ones, were of which there were not many, but there was Pawsey and Bracewell, and then Steinberg and Lequeur came out just as you were starting,
right,
I guess, in
right,
French anyway.
Right, right.
That was about it.
Yeah, but that was not useful because this is a completely different kind of book.
No, they just had one small chapter
right,
on solar radio astronomy.
Right, right.
But I mean, yours is really the first specialized book
right,
in
right,
radio astronomy, you
right,
could say.
Right, yeah, right. And it took a lot of time. In fact, I think it's... I didn't do research for at least 2 years, actually.
That much?
That's about almost that, actually. I used to do little things here and there, but not anything...
It was your main effort.
My main effort went into this, actually.
What about, was there any other solar instruments at Michigan that you used besides this 28-foot dish?
I used this 85-foot dish, I think a couple of times probably. Once for an occultation, for a solar eclipse. Interest was to get this occultation curve. Was a small region, and then differentiate it and get the brightness distribution, you see. That's what I did for a source. But that was the only one I think I got. I published, and on several other occasions I produced maps of 3 centimeter or 1.8 centimeter, but the resolution being of the order of a few minutes of work, it was not really worth anything.
Yeah.
So I didn't publish any of
those. So it seems like you were mainly working actually with the great mass of data, not specifically with data that came from Michigan.
At that time, at Michigan,
during,
yeah, right.
When you were at Michigan.
Right,
yeah.
When I was in Michigan, right. Right.
And then you came to Maryland in 66, I think.
I came to Maryland in 68.
Oh, 68, oh, that yes, was... But now what happened up till about 65 or 6? That's sort of where I'm ending
yeah,
things.
Right. From 62 to 65, March or April, I was in Cornell. So in 64, as I mentioned, beginning of 64, my book was basically finished. So I thought I would spend about a year or so in Arecibo.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, the next major effort I put into research. So I went to Arecibo in June, and I started, just to get back into research, I started by looking at this occultation of Taurus by the solar corona. So I thought, and also by that time, having written a book, I was completely tired of the sun, you see. And as you know, once you work for so many years in a field, I think it's always good to change the field.
Yeah.
So I was just looking for an opportunity to get into some non-solar work. And that was sort of a peripheral thing, in the Taurus and solar corona, so I started doing that.
And now, what was the goal of the occultation?
Well, just same kind of thing, just how the scattering behaves at coronal scattering behaves at a higher frequency, 430 MHz. At the time, not much was known, or if it was known, it was not a completely accepted interpretation or accepted result even, mm-hmm, you see. So that's how I started. So the same kind of things which people have seen at lower frequencies, like the broadening of the curve and decrease of intensity,
mm-hmm,
right around the time the curve came very close, or the closest distance to the sun.
And what frequency were
this
you?
This was at 430
megahertz.
This was the old feed, you see, which had a lot of side lobes, so
mm-hmm,
it made a lot of effort to eliminate the side lobes. I'm not sure if I was able to eliminate it completely, but I thought I had done a good job. So anyway, I published that result, which showed that basically the same thing as at 200 megahertz or so, something like that.
Now what about, this is Arecibo in 64, you say, or 65?
64 to 65, I was there.
Was there much radio astronomy going on at that time there?
Well, little. Then I, as I said, I wanted to get involved into non-solar astronomy. So I started, I don't know what happened. I think Marshall Cohen was doing a lunar occultation.
Who?
Marshall Cohen.
Cohen, yeah.
Was doing lunar occultation systematically. And he was doing it with somebody else, and that somebody else, I think, left after a while. So he asked me to join him, so I was very glad to join him. So observed a few occultations, lunar occultations, which I analyzed, at least for the first time. I was satisfied that I was able to do some non-solar work, which was publishable, and it was, in fact, quite a good result at that time. So that was the time, and then Marshall, I think it was, he was on a leave of absence from Cornell, I mean the main campus, so he had to go back and to teach, I think, mainly. So I was alone. In the meantime, Hazard came, and he has been doing lunar occultation in parks.
Yeah.
And also many other areas, like extended objects, like supernova remnants and so on. And I was supposed to go back to India in 65, anyway. In fact, I was supposed originally to go back in 62, I was just postponing year after year. So I had made up my mind that in 65 I will go back. So I thought the best thing to do for me will be do a couple of things, just to get my hands on, to learn the technique, at least, technique of observing. One was supernova remnants, which I started with Hazard, although Hazard really didn't participate, but he did advise me how to do it and so on. So that's what we have seen probably. I produced a couple of papers on one of the Cygnus loop, W51, W44 and so on, all these things.
Yeah.
That was from Arecibo really. Another thing which was a negative, but at least I've learned something, is flare stars. I literally observed, I don't know, hundreds of hours flare stars, but
I
never could convince myself that I had seen one, although I had records which looked very similar to what Sir Lovell published, you see, but I never could, I had the same kind of thing, I mean one offset antenna and so on, but I could never convince myself that they were any stellar flares. So I never published. I think in my old files I still may be having at least 4 or 5 genuine ones, which I thought I would publish one day, but never. I had in fact collaboration from the Pupil's group. I think that fellow's name was Solomon, I think, who was doing the optical coverage for us, the satellite network. They say, you know, they were doing this Bakerman cameras. They were using the Bakerman cameras. But unfortunately, and I think this is the problem, unfortunately, it was never right. I mean, when we were observing, they were cloudy, or when they were observing, we were not observing, things like that, you see.
Yeah.
So since then, I have convinced myself that that's not the way to work on flare stars. You should build an interferometer, that's the way. Then I think the fringes you cannot produce by any other means.
Right, you can be sure it's not interference.
Right. That's the only way to do flare star work. It's like the way they are doing this guy, that scenario, and I don't know whether they're doing at Westerbork, you know, these things.
Yeah, they're doing a little bit there. Yeah. But you never published even a negative result from these flare stars.
No.
But was that the only other place where extensive flare star work was done in the early days, besides for Jodrell? I'd never heard about this before.
In parks they have done. Sleep. And
using the Parkes dish?
Using Parkes dish, yeah. They published that with us.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about when?
Supposed to be 67, 68.
Oh, is that late? Oh, yeah. So this is after your...
After, yeah.
Yeah, but is
after my observations and after Lovell's...
Is there anything before yours besides for Lovell's work?
I'm not aware. I think Lovell is probably the only person. But I'm not sure. With Lee and company, they might have done something almost at the same time as Lovell, I think. Because they're pretty fast. I don't remember now. I used to remember, but I don't remember now. Since then, they have continued this work, Slee and company, using both Parkes as well as the Kalgoorlie telescope. Really.
Yeah, in the last few years.
In the last few years.
Okay, well, that takes me up to sort of the point where
I went back to India. I joined the Tata Institute of Phenomenal Research, and by the time, you know, Swarup, he was he almost had started this Uti radio telescope project. Here.
Mm-hmm.
I just joined him, so I was there for 3 years, and I was not involved in the design or anything of that instrument, but I was helping in various other ways, like instrumentation. I knew, at least now I have forgotten most of it, but at the time I still knew some. how to analyze the data was, or in other words, in the training period, training of the younger people.
Right.
And basically, one fellow, Velusamy, was there. Actually, he was working with me on the SIBO data anyway. So that's how to start.
I see.
And by that time, actually, Tata Institute had built a solar instrument. It's a sort of an IA-8, which again had was producing some solar records. So I just I didn't do much on that, really, except advise and so on. Because I was, as I mentioned, by the time I was completely tired of solo work, I didn't want to do that.
Now, was Swarup's instrument the first major research effort in India?
That's the major.
Besides from this monitoring.
Right.
And what got this going? I mean, what inspired him? Had he worked in other...
Well, he was in Stanford, and actually there were four Indian astronomers who were supposed to go together and build a sort of a national center for radio astronomy. And Bhava, who was the director of the Tata Institute of Astronomy and Research, invited us.
You say there were four astronomers?
Yeah. In fact, Swarup, myself, Menon, and there was somebody else called Krishnan, T. Krishnan. And they were supposed to go together and build this center. Swarup was the first one to go in 1963. So he started all this in the Tata Institute, and I was the second one to go in 1965. And I just joined him, and I did actually whatever. But he actually basically designed the instrument and helped him in all possible ways, the training of younger people or students. And so on. Besides, I was just analyzing my RCBO data and so on. And that's it.
But did Menon ever...
Menon, now he's there. I think he went to Tata Institute in 1971, I think.
I see. So, well, I didn't realize that he was there. From Hawaii?
From Hawaii he went there, finally. That's where he is now. And T. Krishnan went there, but not at Tata Institute, but he is a separate institute, so he's not. So actually, Swarup was the main main man for India's radio astronomy.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much.
That finishes the interview with McCool Kundu on 18th December 1973 at the University of Maryland.